Hello and welcome to the last episode of Businesses of Tomorrow, a podcast that follows the trials and tribulations of four exciting Aussie founders as they follow their dreams, create jobs and wealth, and hopefully make an impact on the world. In this episode, we're taking a bit of a step back and putting our businesses under the microscope. How sustainable are their business models? We'll be talking to some successful investors, founders, and experts to discover what pitfalls they must look out for and what opportunities exist for them in the future. First, though, a short recap. At the end of the last episode, two of our founders received some great news. Hannah Krawchuk at Love to Dream clinched a deal with Target in the US to supply baby swaddles to all 1,800 of their stores, giving them a foothold in a country where 4 million babies are born per year.
We're planning to triple our business in the next 12 months.
Will Davies raised just over $5 million from investors for his peer-to-peer car sharing company, Car Next Door, and now has expansion on his mind.
I think there's potential for us to be a billion-dollar business.
Jordan O'Reilly from disability support platform HireUp was rubbing shoulders with the top brass at Airbnb and, as a result, is more focused on his goal than ever.
What I care about is how do we build the best business for Australians with disabilities, their families, and the great support workers who care for them.
And Christian Dampstra was also in America, but at his new home in Denver, trying to build a US presence for his company, Dampstra Technology.
In America, they try to boost you up. They're very positive people, and I think that's an amazing thing in an entrepreneur's mind.
Happy days for our founders, but as we are finding out, as you get bigger, so do the problems. So let's get started. Our wise head for this episode is an investor with a long history in the Australian venture capital scene and a mentor in the Businesses of Tomorrow program.
So my name's Simon Cant. I'm the co-founder of ReInventure, which is a $100 million venture fund backed by Westpac. Prior to that, I did venture capital back in the dot-com era. I did a brief period where I was involved in venture philanthropy with Social Ventures Australia, and then came back to, investing in commercial companies during this next wave of disruption.
Simon has seen firsthand the power of disruptive models, the most famous of which tend to be marketplaces that match buyers and sellers. Think Uber and Airbnb. That is the model for Will Davies' Car Next Door, which matches car owners and car renters, and Jordan O'Reilly's HireUp, which matches support workers to people with disabilities. So what should we know about these marketplace businesses?
The thing about marketplace models is they tend to have a winner-takes-all dynamic, right? So ultimately, people really don't want to have to search through two or three different real estate sites to find a house that they want to buy. They don't want to have to check on five taxi apps to see who's got the nearest car. So a lot of these things where it's a two-sided marketplace, you've got sellers on one side and buyers on the other, they tend to eventually consolidate into a single player that is the winner in the market. VCs are aware of that dynamic. It tends to mean that companies starting in strong marketplace dynamic industries will have a ton of money thrown at them in order to try and win that monopoly position. Because in a sense, in the internet, you know, in the old industries, monopolies largely used to be economies of scale. So if you were really good at making something, you could afford to buy equipment that meant you could do it more efficiently than anyone else. That was your protection against a competitor coming in. Now your protection against a competitor coming in is that you have one of these network effects. So VCs and investors are often looking for those network effects, and then they put a lot of money into businesses that might win them because they think they can be so valuable. So Uber is a classic example of that. Airbnb is a classic example of that. In Australia, REA, Domain, they're one of the few where you've still got two who are close enough neck and neck that they can both sustain.
Can you just explain the network effect for someone who doesn't understand how that works?
Yeah, so some of them are marketplaces and sometimes they don't have to be. So something like Facebook has a network effect and it's not a two-sided one. Facebook becomes more useful the more people that are on it. So if I'm the first person on Facebook, it's a desperately lonely and tedious place and I have no interest in being there. If I'm the 100 millionth person on Facebook, suddenly it's interesting, okay? So these are services where one of the number one features is how many other people are using it. And in a marketplace, the number one feature is how many people, if I'm a buyer, the number one feature is how many sellers are on the other side. And if I'm a seller, the number one feature is how many buyers are on the other side. So these are things that become more useful the more people are using them. And therefore, this winner takes all dynamic.
It's a winner take all market. Does Will feel he can be that winner?
We've grown to a reasonable scale now. The big challenge for us is to quadruple or 10 times where we're at the moment so that our marketplace is just where all the liquidity is. And if you want to get a car, you just come to Car Next Door, and to do that as quickly as possible. And you've quite often got to overspend compared to what might seem rational in order to do that, because once you get to that point, you're just in such a great position. But until you get to that point, there is the risk that another company could come in from overseas and start eating away at the market before you've really built it up.
Will is committed to growing fast to make sure that he is the major player before a competitor arrives. Jordan O'Reilly at HireUp has a marketplace model too, but he has thought very differently about scale and growing fast. He doesn't just want to be the middleman.
So one of the really interesting and unique things that HireUp does is we employ all of our support workers. And this was a values-based decision that my sister and I made when we were first setting this up. Everyone said, you should set this up as a contractor-based marketplace and, you know, take an arm's length distance from, you know, the liabilities that can come with it. And my sister and I looked at one another and we said, fundamentally, that's not what we're doing here. We're not setting this up to put the risk, and that there's risk with everything in life. We don't want to put that back on the support workers. That's not actually, you know, I as a young uni student working as a support worker didn't want to bear the risk if something were to go wrong beyond my control. You know, we thought if we're creating a business that's fundamentally about caring for people, we have to care for the people that we're engaging to provide us the services. And they are our support workers. And so my sister and I decided, let's set this up as an employment-based model. And it was a brave decision at the time because we were one of the first companies in the world to bring this peer-to-peer platform technology together with an employment-based model.
It is pretty high risk, though, because in a peer-to-peer thing like Airtasker or Airbnb, you don't own the asset at all, whereas you are actually paying for the resource at the end of it. So how did you think about that model?
So HireUp operates on a casual employment model at the moment, which means that the workers that join the platform can find as much or as little as work as they like. We see the relationships often are lasting for an ongoing period of time, which is fantastic. And we're finding that workers are able to decide how much work they're looking for and can find that on the platform. And that's our job, to make sure that there's enough people seeking support and enough workers to be able to match that properly.
Christian Damstra at Damstra Technology is also chasing scale. He's gone to America to grow his business. Simon Kant says that his road will be longer and growth slower.
It's not clear to me that a business like Christian's has a massive network effect. So, you know, he's putting what are effectively kind of HR or contingent worker platforms in place. Now, the fact that one employer uses that platform isn't going to make it necessarily any better for the next employer who might go and use that platform. So what he does have is he has probably a very sticky value proposition. You know, once an employer is taken on a platform like this, they put all their workers on it. That's a massive installation exercise, and employers are not going to want to do that fast again to switch products. So he's got this very sticky product. He doesn't necessarily have network effects. So to my mind, it is a sensible approach in that sort of business to grow as profitably and efficiently as possible. Because if he throws money at it in an unprofitable way, there's no guarantee that there's going to be this sort of super monopoly at the end of the day that he'll be able to generate super profits out of. Now, there is a risk by going slower that another competitor emerges in the space, sees what he's doing, says, that's an awesome business, I want to do it too.
Christian has moved from a conservative market in Australia to dynamic America, where venture capital firms spend big to gain market share. Is he worried about big spending rivals?
One of the things I notice now that I'm in the States, and obviously I look at a lot of different companies, my organisation runs differently to theirs. And it's something that sometimes you sort of struggle with. Most tech companies don't make money. They go out and get a lot of venture capital, and even Airbnb said that, in the tech game, it's about how much capital you can raise. I don't actually 100% agree with that. I think capital's obviously a means to an end, but I like to run a company and grow a company that is self-sufficient. So I look at some of these companies and, you know, they've been making losses for year on year, and it's like, how are you still in business? And it's because they're being propped up by venture capitalists. That's not our goal. Our goal is to be able to be self-sufficient and continue to run the way we always have. We grow fast and we make profit.
Another fast-growing, profitable business is Love to Dream. CEO Hannah Krawczyk is also chasing customers overseas and plans to double or even triple the business. There is a danger in rapid expansion, however, according to Simon Kant.
I think Hannah's got a great business, and I think she's built an awesome product. It's a big market. I think the challenge in this kind of market is that you can get these fashions, you know. There's a new way that babies should be carried, and this a new swaddle comes along and sort of takes over. So I think you can be affected by that. There aren't big barriers to entry. Once the fashion changes, it's hard to hold on to the market. And I think the other challenge is sometimes when these companies get to a more mature state where they try and diversify into other things, and sometimes they can lose their way a little bit.
Hannah was very conscious when setting up Love to Dream not to repeat the mistakes of the fashion business, where you're constantly guessing what's the next new fashionable thing. How does she feel about the idea of her product being a fad?
We created this category, and we created the demand for this kind of product.
That category is the arms-up baby swaddle. Basically, it's a zip-up sleeping suit where, instead of sleeves, little wings keep the baby's arms up to stop their startle reflex waking them up during the night. She invented it to help her son get to sleep.
This is a great story. My mum was watching the Kerri-Ann Kennelly show, and there was a girl on there, a lady on there, who had designed some baby bags, and she had a patent. She was talking about her patent, and I had just designed the swaddle up, and my mum rang me. She goes, "Oh, don't you think you should maybe try and get a patent for this product?" And I thought, "Oh, that's quite good." And I drew up the sketches of the garment and wrote down what I thought was special about it. I lodged the application myself. And now, of course, I have lawyers who do that kind of thing for me. But that was absolutely critical to our success, because we can protect ourselves and be the only product with arms up. And this is the only way to sleep your child now. So it gives us a huge competitive advantage.
Can you just talk to me about the moment when you handed that patent in? How did it feel at the time?
Amazing. It was the best $80 I'd ever spent. It was so exciting, because now all of a sudden I was an inventor.
An innovation to help Hannah's son sleep better is helping her create a $100 million business. Another innovation around care is the basis for Jordan O'Reilly's business. It's called the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and it is a new model for service delivery for people with disabilities. Under the scheme, spending on those services will go from $7 billion to $22 billion, and people with disabilities or their carers will have much more choice in what support they take on. HireUp is right in that sweet spot with their matching platform. But, as Simon Kant warns, there are dangers when relying on government funding models.
I've seen this a lot with the non-profit sector, and I suspect that it may be one of those things that Jordan will face into potentially a little bit with HireUp, which is that the government gets really tight on program delivery funding. And so it usually doesn't like providing a lot of funding for capacity. And so it can just be really hard to run these models on a sustainable basis. You know, the government is always looking at cost cutting, and it's kind of easier for the government to look out and cost cut at service providers than it is for the government to look in and actually make, for example, job cuts within government, etc. You start having to tighten your belt, and it becomes hard to run a sustainable business.
In some ways, Jordan has three customers: those with disabilities, support workers, and the government. So it is worth bringing in another expert here. Rob Koskar is the current CEO of Social Ventures Australia. They help social enterprises like Jordan's grow and succeed. He has seen that the process of outsourcing services can be fraught. If the sector doesn't properly communicate the value of what they do, politicians, bureaucrats, advocacy groups, and the media may start to question where the money is going. According to Rob Koskar, that means innovators in the sector may find they are lobbyists as much as business operators.
I think the best ones actually really use their market position to drive the boundary of regulation and good practice and really put in place safeguards for the consumer. Because particularly when you end up with mixed models of for-profit and not-for-profit providers in different segments, that's where you do see differences in the objectives. And sometimes, governments can be tempted to go down a road which costs them less money but delivers actually lower quality services to consumers. And it's really important that the social enterprises in those markets maintain a strong advocacy position for high quality outcomes that are well delivered to really meet people's needs.
It's not just government budgets that Jordan needs to worry about. He also has to think about how the program is administered and regulated.
The regulation challenge is one for all of us. It's not one just for regulators or just for the government or just for business or just for the community. It's actually something that we all have to engage in. And I'm really proud of the sort of natural instinct that me and my sister had when we first started this business, was that we actually want to consult as broadly as possible. Like, we want to go and talk to regulators. We want to talk to unions. We want to talk to government. We want to talk to everyone we possibly can about what we're doing, because it made sense to us that if you achieve the scale that you want to, you're going to be impacting, all of these stakeholders, and it's really important that we all, go along for the journey. And I think the NDIS, as we said, is this extraordinary reform that's happening, and it's all about really changing the power dynamic and giving people with disabilities and their families much more choice and control. And so I think there's an inevitable regulatory response that you can sort of start to see emerging, and I just really hope that we're able to all work together to make sure that we don't put in place regulations that go too far in limiting that choice and control that people now enjoy. I think it's incredibly important that we get the regulation right, because you can't build a new system without building all of the framework around it that helps keep people safe, that helps make sure that there's no sort of misuse of the system or anything like that. But for us, trying to build a new model within a new government funding model, that's a piece that keeps me up at night. If it goes the wrong way, it could stifle innovation, which would be a real shame in the sector.
Jordan's passion, stemming from his childhood caring for his profoundly disabled brother Shane, is plain for all to see. His conviction and commitment is the best advertisement for what he is trying to achieve with HireUp, and is the driving force behind the culture there. But Jordan's business is growing fast. It doubled in staff size last year. Car Next Door is growing rapidly too, and as these businesses grow, culture becomes a particularly important issue.
My name's Tim Fung. I'm the co-founder and the CEO at Airtasker. Airtasker is an online and mobile marketplace, and we connect people and small business together with members of the local community. We have 90 employees here in Sydney, 50 in Manila, and 5 in London.
Tim Fung knows something about hypergrowth and what that does to a business.
I often used to hear people talking about culture and recruitment and all of these kinds of things. And at the beginning, I was like, oh, that's not important. As long as I had revenue growing and sales growing, that would be the most important thing. But as you actually do start to hit some of these milestones, you start realizing, oh, geez, if I don't get this culture right and I don't get this recruitment funnel right and our people operations right, I'm going to really struggle to keep going. I think it took us a little longer than usual, and I think it was definitely a pitfall that we didn't put enough effort into the beginning. But certainly a few years into the journey, it became an immensely high priority. And so I guess that's where I spend almost all of my time now.
On the cultural aspect of the organization?
For sure, whether it's recruitment, retention of really, really high talent, or whether it's about focusing on the way we work, so organisational structure, processes.
Will Davies has been looking at ways to keep the culture consistent as Car Next Door grows.
When we came back from the program, I've spent a lot of time really honing down on our vision and mission. We had a mission, but the mission was probably about 100 words, had a whole bunch of details in it. It was really boring. No one could remember it. What our mission is now is to free the world from the one person, one car mentality. That's what our mission is. And it really sums up everything that we're trying to do in one sentence. And that's something that the team can rally around. We've had the vision and mission and values, but they've been kind of a page on our internal systems. So I've really tried to bring that front and center. So on our communication systems, little vision, mission and values points pop up all the time now. We're getting a whole bunch of posters made just to bring that all to front of line. We're making a special page on our website where the vision and mission are now front and center. And that was directly from you know, some of the stuff we learn at LinkedIn, the stories and the myths of the company, you've got to work out how to scale them as the business grows.
Over at Love to Dream, Hannah Krawchuk has also seen how important culture was at Airbnb and is baking cultural questions into all their interviews.
What I learned at Airbnb was that they have a 12 interview hiring process, and that was revolutionary for me. And so we actually have implemented something similar, not to that level, but we now interview for culture first, and we have two interviews around that, and then the last interview is around skill set, and we involve other people in the company in those interviews now who we wouldn't have necessarily involved because it was always management.
And have you got a question that you ask in interviews now that you don't use them before?
Yes.
What is it?
What's your spirit animal? I think that... and the people, some people get really stumped by that question, and I think that that's a much better way to ask. You know, everyone always asks, how would your friends describe you, or how would your last boss describe you, and you have your prescribed answers. But when you describe your spirit animal, you haven't thought about that before necessarily, and so you tend to get more honest and more transparent answers.
And what's yours?
A puma.
Why?
Because they... Because they sleek and powerful and beautiful. Can I say that?
Yeah.
Christian Damstra has a different problem. Like most founders, the culture of the company is based around him. But he has moved overseas, leaving the staff behind. Clearly, he feels confident that things won't go off the rails in his absence. Is it working?
One of the things I did after the Westpac Business of Tomorrow tour was really sit down and make sure I had my organisational structure right and had the right culture and the right people in the right place. I mean, that was a glaring story that came out of nearly every business we went to, from LinkedIn to Airbnb. In my honest opinion, it's a very positive step forward, me stepping out of that everyday stuff and leaving the country, because as the founder, being there on a daily basis, everybody relies on you for many things that they shouldn't be relying on you for, that they should either be making a decision themselves or relying on their immediate team leader, for example. But it was always easier to go to the founder because I had the answers, because I've been there the longest. Now that I'm sort of less contactable, the business is thriving in that area and the team is working extremely well together, and I'm seeing leap and bound improvements in the way that that functionality works. So I'm extremely happy.
Are you finding that there's better solutions than what you would have come up with coming through the organisation?
Absolutely. I'm one person. We've gone from just shy of 30 employees to 70 employees in under 12 months. I can't do everything myself. If you can't let go as a founder and trust your team and build a team that adds value to your organisation, that's when you have those people who say things like, a founder should never be a CEO, because they can't differentiate between the two. I don't totally agree with that if you're willing to let go and let people do their job.
Hannah Krawchuk is finding that, like Christian, hiring the right people and letting them get on with it is incredibly freeing.
I've shifted my daily routine, and so I am now really, really focused on absolutely critical tasks that will move the business forward. And that's been a big change, rather than kind of fluffing around and answering things that are not critical. I'm now spending my time doing what is critical, and therefore we will see greater growth. I have just said to my team that you guys can just make the decisions yourselves. If it's going to cost me a lot of money, come and let me know. Otherwise, just do it. And that's been fabulous, because why did I hire them if they're not capable of making those really important decisions? And they all are. So off you go. It's been great.
Liberating?
Yeah, fantastic, because I'm actually now doing really cerebral work.
And that really, in a nutshell, has been the huge benefit of the Businesses of Tomorrow program. Our founders are smart people, good at business and passionate about what they do. But in seeing how great businesses work, learning from each other and putting in place structures to help them manage their companies better, they have had a chance to think more deeply about what they want to achieve in this world. I'll let them tell you.
Look, the reason that I started Car Next Door was because I want to reduce the amount of carbon that humans are putting into the world. So I want to be spending my time on that, which is going to help achieve that aim the fastest. What we're disrupting is everyone feeling like they need to own two cars or three cars or even one car if they live in the city. You just don't need to own it. You can just use the other stuff that's around there. So we're disrupting car ownership.
The vision for HireUp is to go on and become Australia's number one provider of home care and support. I think it can be even bigger than that, and that to really genuinely make a change for people all over the world, how can we take what we're doing here and scale it up?
We want to make a global company to grow something that we can look back on in 10, 20 years, 30 years and say we played a part in that.
Not in a million years did I think that we would make the impact that we've made. That's been the biggest surprise. The fact that I have a successful business is probably not the surprise because I was always going to make that happen. But how rewarding it feels is the surprise.
And now that you've done that, have you set a new horizon for yourself?
Yeah. Well, I think it's about unconstrained thinking and really this can be a global heavy hitter. So that's how I'm looking at things now. But it's more around the psychology of don't think in 30% growth, 50% growth. What happens when you ask yourself and your team, I want to grow by 500%? And what are the three steps I need to do to grow by 500%? What does that look like? Because that changes the game. We would have to be we would need to be a household name around the world to do that.
Here's to global visions, household names, and passion combined with purpose. This series was sponsored by Westpac, who sent our founders along with 16 other businesses on that global trip and gave them access to mentors like Tim Fung and Simon Kent, as well as consulting support. If you have a business that you think is ready for a grander vision, go to businessesoftomorrow.com.au. This series was produced and reported by me, Jackson Hewitt, and edited by Taylor Denny. The consulting producer was Catherine Franey, and our executive editor for podcasts at The Australian is Eric George. And while this may be the last episode, please don't feel the moment is over. We would love it if you could share this podcast series with friends and more, or give us a rating. We try to make this podcast as useful as possible to someone in business or aspiring to run one, so we'd love to get the message out. A special shout out as we finish up to a couple of people who are involved in this series. Of course, our founders, Hannah, Jordan, Christian and Wilver, being so accessible and open and quite inspirational to me, I must say. Also to Levi Guillory, Georgia Thomas and Anthony Guattari at The Australian, Anna McFarlane at Westpac and Josephine George at Map and Page. Finally, many thanks to my partner, Felicity, who has been caring for our daughter, Ruby, who you met in episode one, while I've worked nights and weekends to put this podcast together. Thanks to you all. And thanks most of all to you for listening.